91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. No one professes to be an irrational voter, but historian Rick Schenkman says we decidedly are, and worse, it's in our DNA. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Schenkman is an investigative reporter as well and heads the History News Network. His new book is Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. The silliest things repeatedly affect election outcomes, and those who call for more voter information are themselves sadly misinformed. The vast majority of voters don't make the slightest effort to know the facts, for trusting one's so-called instincts is the norm. So learn more, stay with us, Topical Currents up next after the news.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, it seems the more that science is successful at understanding how our primate brains developed, the less confidence we can give to rational, informed political choices.
To thrive in the Stone Age, humans didn't need the skill to appraise candidate debates or political rhetoric on television. We're now with investigative reporter, historian, editor, and author Rick Schenkman.
He's the editor of the History News Network, and among other books, he's written Political Animals, and also Just How Stupid Are We Facing the Truth About the American Voter.
His latest work is Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics.
And Rick Schenkman joins us now from Seattle. Welcome to you, Rick.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you made it because it's the day after Super Tuesday, and I thought that was a great time to have you on. So were you surprised by any of the results given the information you've written about in your book?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very surprised by Bernie Sanders' surprise success over the last few months. I didn't anticipate that last fall, but I fully anticipated that Donald Trump would make a good run for president, and I'm not surprised that so far he's leading the GOP pack.
What's the reasoning, do you think, behind Bernie's progress?
I'm still baffled by it. A 74-year-old man from, white Jewish man from Brooklyn, I just never anticipated that he was going to resonate with voters the way that he has. And all I can think is that there's really a lot of unfulfilled aspirations among the American people, I think, who were either disappointed in Obama or just hungry for some populist to come along and say, this is how we're going to solve our problems.
You know, it's jumping ahead, and of course we're going to get into, you know, the meat of your book, but I was wondering about Bernie Sanders myself, because you say that one of the failures, which we're going to get to, is why we punish politicians who tell us hard truths. And Bernie Sanders has been forthright with some very hard truths, but he has this substantial groundswell of support.
Well, does he have hard truths? Here's what I'm hearing from a lot of his young supporters. He's going to give them free college. He's going to give them free health care. That doesn't sound like hard truths to me.
Mm. Okay, good point. Well, we're in this mode, but you say our brains are literally not configured to work within a large democracy. So they're not wired that way. What do you mean?
So our brains evolved to address the problems that hunter-gatherers faced in the Stone Age, which was a 2.5 million long period. And that, unfortunately, is not the brain that we need in the 21st century. We're not members of small communities of between 100 and 150 people anymore. We're members of communities in the hundreds of millions, if not the billions of people. And our instincts, as a result, are in conflict with our needs as citizens in this large universe that we now inhabit. And that's really the problem. what happens with most voters is that they go with their instincts. But when your instincts are really only helpful if you're living in a small community where everybody knows everybody, then you really run into trouble if you go on your instincts living in the kind of mass democracy that we live in here in the United States. And that is our basic problem with politics. That's the main argument that I'm making in Political Animals.
Well, Rick, touch on how in the book you talk about that in an evolutionary standpoint, our human circle really was only about 150 familiar persons. That's what we were brought up to be able to deal with.
Well, let's take a look at just this whole problem of apathy. In the last midterm elections, something like 37% of eligible voters voted. What can account for that kind of apathy? It doesn't make any sense when you think about human beings and the way the human brain is configured. We are curious beings. From the moment we are born, we're looking around, we're searching, we want new information, we want to understand the world that we're living in. We're totally engaged. So how is it that all these millions of people were unengaged in the last midterm election? What is going on there? I suspect that what is really going on is that in our brain, we are engaged with the world immediately around us, quite literally the world that is touching us, that is physical to us. We cannot really become engaged if we go on our instincts with a community of millions of people. That's stuff that's happening out there somewhere. It's too abstract. It's happening at a distance. And so people just think, well, I can just go on with my life without having to worry about what's going on in Washington, D.C., or something that's going on in Syria, a place most people can't even find on the map. And so their brain is telling them, ignore all this stuff. Besides, a lot of politics is aggravating, so who wants to be involved with it? Whereas hunter-gatherers, there's no sign that hunter-gatherers were ever apathetic about who was in charge, because these were the people they were living with and who they were working with. So when you start to understand our politics from this evolutionary perspective, it starts to make sense.
Rick, you know, reading your book made me wonder about this, okay? Given how long ago the Stone Age was, and would how many, is that 200,000 years ago?
Well, no, the Stone Age only ended about 10,000 years ago.
Okay, 10,000 years ago. Okay, I got that wrong. But why haven't our brains adapted or evolved to modern life in 10,000 years? Since our brains evolved to meet the needs of the Stone Age and hunter-gatherers and 150 people, why haven't they adapted and re-evolved to meet the needs of modern times?
Biological evolution is a relatively slow process. E.O. Wilson at Harvard suggests that it takes about 25,000 years for a major adaptation to take place in a species. So we haven't had a long enough period of time here to really evolve and adapt. And when you think about it, we've really only been members of these mass democratic societies for the last 150, 250 years. So it's not even thousands of years. We're only talking about a couple of hundred years. And the life of a species that can be traced back millions of years, that's just a nanosecond. That's just a nothing. Culture, on the other hand, changes really, really fast. It's super fast. So it's the difference between the tortoise and the hare. Biological evolution is like that tortoise. Cultural evolution is like the hare. And one of the, I give a talk on political animals, and one of the points I make is that 100 years ago, exactly 100 years ago, down in Waco, Texas, tens of thousands of citizens of that community turned out to watch a man be lynched. And they watched as his body was set on fire, his fingers were cut off, he was castrated, and just destroyed as a human being. Today, just 100 years later, we are appalled. We don't even want to think about this happening. So that's the progress of cultural evolution. It's super fast, but biological evolution is slow. And our instincts, the kind of evolved psychological mechanisms that I'm talking about in the book, those are rooted in our biology. That's the problem.
Well, you go back even farther than Homo sapiens, like to Homo erectus, and millions of years.
Yes, well, we are part of the chimp line, which we only broke off from the chimpanzee about 5 or 6 million years ago. So we have a very, very long evolved history, and our primate brain is often in charge.
I wanted to ask you, you know, you're not talking about, I mean, our instincts work fine for us in many different ways. You're not saying don't trust our instincts. You're saying do not, or that we, I mean, because we've been told our whole life, most of our lives, most of us, to trust our instincts, trust our gut. So you're saying not that we can't trust our instincts ever, but when it comes to politicians, there's a disconnect. Why is that?
Well, exactly. So if you are facing a jaguar in the jungle, which our hunter-gatherer ancestors did, you have to have the same kind of instinct responses as if you face a psychopath in a dark alley in a modern American city, right? So our instincts can work if the context is correct and the same. But in politics, the context is totally different. It's totally different. So let me give you a perfect example, which comes to reading people. Back in the hunter-gatherer age, when you were trying to read somebody and read their intentions, you'd, of course, go after, you'd be thinking about their body language, what their facial muscles were telling you, were they squinting, did they seem like they were nervous, all these different things, right? And we do that today. But here's the difference. Back then, you were making that assessment about reading somebody based on real deep knowledge about that person. You weren't just making an assessment on their body language. You knew them because you lived in the same small community. This wasn't even like a small town. This was like just living on a bunch of people living around a block where everybody lives together and they work together. Today, when you're trying to read somebody you see on television, you'll see the politician and you'll have an immediate response, just like our hunter-gatherers ancestors did. But when we are reading them on television, we don't have the context that the hunter-gatherers did because we don't live with them. We don't work with them. We don't know them intimately. Here's a wonderful example that I use in the book, which is Richard Nixon during the Watergate controversy. So what was one of the major turning points in Watergate? It was when the transcripts of his conversations in the White House were first revealed. And what did they show? They showed that Richard Nixon swore. This was devastating to him because he had long made a reputation of being somebody who's kind of like a Boy Scout in private, at least.
A Quaker.
He was a Quaker, yes. And this was a guy who wouldn't swear, even though he'd been a sailor in World War II, and we all know that, you know, he was in the Navy in World War II. He was a lieutenant. And we know what people talk about, the stereotype about sailors, right, is that they swear a lot. But we had this public impression that Richard Nixon didn't swear. In the 1960 campaign against Kennedy, he often denounced Harry Truman for his use of salty language. That really resonated with people. So when the Watergate transcripts come out, and it turns out that Richard Nixon actually swore a lot, well, people were just shocked. Now think about that. When you actually know somebody, you find out probably within 5 or 10 minutes of talking to them in person, if you're in, you know, somebody's living room or something, whether this is somebody who swears. This is not some big state secret. You just know it. But the American people didn't know this about Richard Nixon, and that's because even though they had seen him for decades on television, they didn't know him. When we see politicians on TV, we don't really know them. But our brain tricks us into thinking that we know them because our brain says, oh, I can interpret their body language and their facial muscles. But that only works in context. And the point of my book is that we have to second-guess our instincts in politics because we have to keep asking ourselves, is the context right? So you may think you're good at reading people in your personal life, but is that the same context as in politics.
Okay.
And invariably, it's not.
Well, we're going to just continue our conversation with Rick Schenkman about his book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics, when we come back from this break.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with historian, editor, and author Rick Schenkman about his book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Rick, in doing so many of these programs, many of our guests always say, well, education is needed if people go out of their way to educate themselves. But it appears that no amount of educational urgings by people result in people actually doing voter research, including going to sites like Vote Smart and that. Why is it that people really refuse to find out the facts on their own?
Well, I challenge in the book the assumption of civics reformers that all we need to do is give people more facts. You know, I love facts, but facts don't change people's minds. Somebody who is a really committed climate change denier won't be changing his mind if you give him a lot of facts from biology and evolutionary theory and all the rest that says human beings are affecting our climate. And this is because we have built-in biases. The assumption that we make and that civics reformers make is that we really want the truth. And actually, as Harvard's Steven Pinker has pointed out, we don't want the truth. We want our version of the truth. That's all we want. And we believe what we believe. And we advanced as a species because individuals were really pugnacious in pushing their own beliefs. How do you get a bunch of people in a room to change their opinion? You just are really bullheaded. And you just stick to your guns, and eventually you wear people down. This is what Donald Trump has been doing in this GOP race. He's been wearing all these other people down. He just keeps saying the same thing over and over and over again. And because it resonates with people, they want to believe that the other is responsible for all of our problems, whether the other is Mexicans who are coming across the southern border, or whether it's Muslims who are coming into this country and committing terrorist acts, whatever it happens to be. That happens to resonate with people, in part because of our Stone Age brain. We are always, that's a button you can push, and you've always been able to push it, which is the fear of the other. Our brain tells us that what we need is to hang on to a belief that helps us understand the way the world works, and nobody can really talk us out of that. Up to one, there is one loophole. There's an escape hatch from this, which has saved human beings from kind of an overly rigid dogmatism. And I can get into that if you'd like.
Yes. Well, after.
I wanted to know also, though, is if cognitive dissonance, the of conflicting beliefs, is involved in this too.
It absolutely is, and I'm glad you brought that up. So cognitive dissonance, as people who have taken Psychology 101 know, happens when we hold a belief and then we discover some contrary fact. So what happens then? Well, we have dissonance in our brain. We're trying to hold two ideas simultaneously in our mind, and as anybody knows, that's really difficult to do. So what does our brain automatically do? Automatically, it takes the bit of new information that it has come across, and it says, hey, this is giving us anxiety here. It's messing with our brain. It's creating dissonance in our brain. Let's ignore it. And that is what we do routinely. That's why belief trumps fact. And that's what politicians count on all the time. That's what political parties count on all the time. That's what demagogues count on. As long as you can get somebody to initially go along with you, then that's it. Doesn't matter how many facts come out. That's why Donald Trump isn't worried so much about all of these media sites that keep calling him on the carpet for lying about the Muslims who were supposedly dancing on the rooftops of apartment buildings in Jersey City when they saw the Twin Towers collapse. Well, he doesn't care because he's already got these people on his side, and they hear that some media people are saying that he was making a statement that wasn't true. They don't care about that. That immediately goes out of their head. And we have MRI lab experiments that show what happens when that information comes into the brain. It goes into a corner where it can immediately become inactive. The neurons literally go dead. So, or almost literally, the neurons never die, but they become inactive. They're turned off. And that allows the rest of the brain to feel really comfortable with its existing beliefs. So our own brain is against us. So these civics reformers who say we just have to give people a lot of facts, it's just nonsense. It's inconsistent with the modern findings of neuroscience. And these are findings that we've only had now about 15 years to digest. And I think that's, I know that that has not really been absorbed. And it's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is I came across this science and I wanted to bring it out to a larger audience.
Rick, you say, sticking on Donald Trump for just a moment, you say that his popularity is based largely on activating fear and anger in us. But you say something interesting also, that more than any other candidate on either side, he's successful because he's making the campaign about them, the voters, more than he's making it about himself, which is very ironic. So is he really doing that, or is he just seemingly doing that? Is he making vote? I mean, he's not really making it about the voters, is he?
I think he really is. And you said it's ironic. And it's ironic because, of course, when we think of Donald Trump, we think of this immense ego. He's narcissistic. He's egotistical. He puts his name on his buildings, on universities, on his helicopter, on his airplane. There hasn't been a narcissist like this, I don't know since when, in American politics. But his whole campaign is based on how the voters feel. And this is critical. Every election always comes down in the end, not to what the candidates are saying or how they look or how they comb their hair or how they dress. What it comes down to is how the voter feels when they go into the voting booth and pull that lever. So what are Donald Trump voters feeling? They are feeling smart. The media thinks these voters are dumb, but these voters are feeling smart because he is validating the feelings that they have had for years. They have not liked political correctness. They have not liked Muslims coming here and blowing things up. They have not liked Mexicans coming and taking their jobs, right? These are all things, gut feelings that they have had. They've been in a quiet rage. Donald Trump has said, don't live in a quiet rage. You can just express them. And with me as your candidate, I'm validating your feelings. So these guys are feeling validated. They're feeling smart. And that's why Donald Trump is winning in so many of these states.
But what about thinking? I mean, are you saying that we can't separate thoughts from feelings? Because if they had higher cognitive thinking at any point, they would realize that none of this makes sense.
Well, you cannot separate. This is another of the findings of science in the last 25 years. You cannot separate higher order cognitive thinking from emotion. They work hand in glove. But quite clearly, there is a difference between operating on instinct and using higher order cognitive thinking to reflect and to think about thinking. This is called metacognition. Well, the ordinary voter is not thinking about thinking. They are just going on instinct. And particularly low information voters, which is the base for the Donald Trump campaign, they are so cut off from outside sources of information that they don't have a good, strong basis for challenging the claims that they're hearing from Donald Trump. So they're just listening to him. He's validating their feelings, and they're going with those feelings, with those gut feelings. And that's a real problem. That's why we want informed voters. It's not inconsistent with what I just said a moment ago about how...
Right, facts don't matter.
Facts don't matter, because clearly if you have access to a wider range of knowledge, and in other words, this is knowledge that's in your brain already, then when you hear somebody say something, you can evaluate it if you play a little game with yourself, which is to say, I'm not going to go on instinct. I'm actually going to use my brain, my noggin here, to evaluate the information. We're all capable of that as human beings, but most people don't do that in politics.
Well, we're upon a break. Rick Schenkman, Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter, author and publisher and editor of the History News Network. He's written Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also Rick Schenkman, historian, editor, and author. Rick, tell us a little bit about what you use in the book, the example of Bob Woodward, and that it's easier, finding a lie is easier face-to-face than if you see someone on television or on their website.
Almost always when there are stories in the news about politicians, you find that newspaper reporters in particular, but journalists in general, are ahead of the curve. They always seem to be understanding, for instance, in Watergate, Bob Woodward was far ahead of the American people in understanding that Nixon was crooked and that the White House was up to its neck in shenanigans against the Democratic Party. So why is that? Well, here's the difference. When you are reading about Watergate or some other controversy in the news, you're just reading about it. When a journalist goes out and is covering the story, they're actually talking to human beings face-to-face. It is one thing to open up your newspaper and see that so-and-so told the reporter this, and the reporter found out that actually that wasn't true. That's one thing. When you are the reporter and somebody lies to your face, that really has an impact on you. And that's a wake-up call. And that's how we're designed. We're designed to live in an immediate world. Our nervous system works that way. It doesn't work by reading about something. It works by interacting through experience. So that's the big advantage that journalists have over voters. And what voters need to understand is that their instincts are not geared to the challenges they face as voters in a modern 21st century democracy. In a small little town, you can rely on your instincts when you're voting on something where it involves your neighbors, and you know your neighbors, and you know your mayor, your city council people, but not when we're dealing with a mass democracy. That's the problem.
Okay, so here we are. We can't trust our instincts. We can't trust our gut when it comes to politics. We can't trust politicians because we can't. So where does that leave us? Who or what should we be doing?
All right, yeah, you can't trust your politicians because whether they know the science or not, politicians are great psychologists, so they know how to manipulate people and manipulate people's instincts.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Donald Trump keeps doing. He keeps pushing these fear and anger buttons, and he keeps getting these responses. We're all just like monkeys in a cage. He's giving us the juice drink, and we're going, oh, yay.
Okay, so what's our next move? What's the escape hatch here?
All right, so the escape hatch is that, first of all, by being aware of how we respond, you now can begin to become an educated voter, because what you are doing is you are second-guessing your own automatic, instantaneous responses. That's critical to enlightenment. Once you get to that point and you start asking yourself, well, why am I reacting this way? Don't just react. Ask yourself every time you react, why am I reacting this way? What button is being pushed? And that will help. Now, let's talk about the escape hatch. This is really important. So I talked earlier about how dogmatic beliefs are the norm. It's very hard to talk somebody out of something that they believe in, even if you dump a truckload of documents on them and have a zillion facts on your side. But there is part of the human brain that helps us confront facts, and it's anxiety. So we were talking earlier about cognitive dissonance. So you have a strong belief against climate change, and then you start seeing all these stories about human-induced human as a factor in bringing on climate change. Well, it doesn't really, it goes in one ear out the other. It doesn't really affect you. Mm-hmm. But suppose you see these cliffs, these snow cliffs in Greenland falling into the ocean. Now you are having a nervous system reaction to that. Once somebody explains what that means, you are seeing it, and if, of course, you were actually sitting in a boat in the ocean watching this, you would have a very dramatic nervous reaction. That would trigger anxiety. When the burden of hanging on to your old belief becomes greater than the cost of changing it, we change our opinions. This is the saving grace for human beings, because if we didn't have anxiety, we'd never change. So anxiety is really critical. This is why I say emotion and reason work hand in glove.
Right.
So,
but are you saying that you have to have physical proof? Are you saying that that person that can only get the anxiety not hearing about the ice melting in Greenland, but actually witnessing it, seeing it?
I think reading about it won't trigger the proper anxiety effect. Mm. But seeing it really helps. We are visual creatures. Up to half of the human brain is occupied with tasks involved in vision. So if we can see something, even if we're not there, but we're just seeing a piece of tape on television or in a YouTube video or something, that almost takes a hold of your brain, and it stops every other part of your brain from operating because your brain is working so hard to digest this visual information. And that can have an impact. It's going to take time. But here's what's interesting. For the American people right now, a majority say that climate change is real, it's happening, and that human beings are responsible for it.
You raised Watergate a little while ago, though.
Yep.
As far as the visual image, to me, it wasn't the profanity at Nixon, but the 18.5-minute gap in the tape and Rosemary Woods demonstrating how she accidentally erased that portion of the tape. That was a visual, and it was so silly. I think a lot of people lost it then.
Well, exactly. I have a whole chapter in the book about Nixon and Watergate, and what I point out is that it took the American people 11 months from the time Watergate began before they finally came to terms with the facts, and his support started to decline precipitously. So it takes time. We don't just change on a dime our opinions, but there is an accumulation. Slowly, over time, the facts will eventually win out. The problem, of course, is like take climate change. If it takes us decades before substantial majorities of the American people not only accept climate change is happening and that it's human-induced, but that we need to do something about it, well, it's going to be too late. That's the problem with our anxiety function. It was designed for the Stone Age when we didn't have to worry about changing our behavior, because if we don't change our behavior today, decades from now, we're going to screw up the planet. That just was never part of the calculus of the Stone Age existence. but that is part of our calculus now. If we don't make the changes now, in other words, if we have to wait until we can turn on our TV at night and every night be watching these snow cliffs just fall into the ocean, if we have to wait for that, it's too late, right? Because scientists say if we don't act now, we'll have irreversible effects of climate change. So that's the problem we have, and I recommend that we ought to be running TV commercials showing these cliffs falling and just showing them over and over and over again until people finally get it.
We're speaking with Rick Schenkman. He is an investigative reporter, author, publisher, and editor. And he's written Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Our last break. We'll be right back. And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, visiting with Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter Rick Schenkman, talking about his latest book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics.
And what about the idea that the voters are also just too stubborn to accept corrections to their beliefs?
Well, voters, as we've seen, are very, very stubborn. Once a voter makes up their mind about a political candidate, for example, like these Trump voters, it's very, very hard for them to change their opinion. And I know this from firsthand experience. Here's my confession, which I talk about in the book. I was one of those Nixon voters who stuck by Nixon all the way until he darn near resigned. Only 2 months before he resigned did I finally give up on Nixon.
Wow, why?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I was I was in college, and I was following the Watergate news. I knew the story backwards and forwards. I didn't have a dearth of facts that was hobbling me. I knew all the facts. But I kept coming up with rationalization after rationalization. That was because I did not step back. Instinct was driving my beliefs. I was in the tank for Richard Nixon. And the more that I defended him, the more my own identity was at stake. You know, earlier we talked about how elections are always in the end about the voters, not the candidates. Well, my defense of Richard Nixon in the end wasn't about Richard Nixon and whether he was telling the truth. It was about myself. This is called justification theory. So,
is this partly this need to be right? I mean, would people rather be right than know the facts?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
It's because here's what happens. If we are committed to something and let's say it's an ordeal, and there have been all these social science experiments that prove this. You are forced to undergo some initiation ceremony to become a member of a fraternity, for example. Typically, from the outside, these initiation ceremonies seem ridiculous. Like, you know, you had to strip down to your underwear and people paddled you. I mean, what's all that about? You'd think that, you know, all these recruits would just put on their pants and run. But what happens in the human brain is once they go through it, then they have to ask themselves, and they don't have to be conscious about this. This is just an automatic processing thing. They'd say, well, why did I just allow myself to go through that? It must have been for a good reason because I'm not an idiot. So I must have done this for a really good reason. And you talk yourself into it. And so the higher the hurdle that you have jumped to get into this fraternity or to defend a Richard Nixon as I was doing, the more I had to defend him, the more I was confronted with this challenge of, well, I'm a smart person. I know all these facts. So why am I still defending this guy? Well, I'm a smart person, and I don't want to admit that I'm not a smart person. So I double down. That's the psychological mechanism at work there.
Well, did you happen to see the John Oliver last week tonight about Donald Trump?
If we're talking about the same one.
The Trump. Yes,
I saw that.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking you that is because what he does is he takes just about everything that Donald Trump has said and done, and he refutes it and gives all the facts of it. So if people that are supporting Donald Trump would watch that Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, does it mean that they would get so much anxiety hearing the truth that they wouldn't want to vote for him anymore? Or would they just rationalize it and say, oh, John Oliver doesn't know what he's talking about?
I think John Oliver can so easily be stigmatized in their minds as part of the liberal media that they can dismiss out of hand anything that he's saying. If you really want to convince these Trump supporters that they shouldn't be voting for Donald Trump, it's got to be one of their own kind who is persuading them that Donald Trump is a bad bet. In other words, it's got to be somebody who's got credibility in their world. It can't be somebody like Donald Trump, I mean, like John Oliver, who they're not watching every night, who's now telling them these are the facts and this is, you know, you need to change your opinion. So it's got to come from somebody in their own community.
Concerning people who don't vote, the apathy that we see so strongly, is it that some people almost hold it as a badge of honor that they don't vote? It's their way of saying, well, stick it to the system. I'm not even going to participate. It's so ridiculous.
Well, you know, this is a question about which social scientists are broadly divided. Economists argue that it makes no sense for any individual to vote because no individual single vote is likely to make any kind of a difference in a typical election. So why should you vote? So in other words, rational politics suggests, rational theory suggests that you shouldn't vote because it's not in your self-interest. Most political scientists reject that kind of thinking. They say, well, human beings aren't actually rational creatures, so that's out the window. But then the political scientists have their own explanations. My explanation is I go back to this Stone Age brain business. It's just it's so easy to convince yourself that what's happening out there in distant lands or in Washington, D.C., which is thousands of miles away from where you were, from where most Americans live, that you just write it off. It's like it's not impacting my personal life.
Yeah.
So what are some, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about the good things about the brain and how we can be better judges of the candidates and how we can make better decisions.
Well, the very first and most important point is to acknowledge your own brain's limitations. We each of us come with a brain with 86 billion neurons. So we are all smart. Nobody's so dumb that they can't follow American politics. We're smart enough. But part of being smart enough means accepting the limitations of our brain because we're not suited for being citizens in a multi-party mass democracy involving hundreds of millions or billions of people. So that's the first thing. The second point that I would make is that when you are watching candidates on TV, I would suggest that there are here's a way that you can help protect yourself from automatic responses. When you're watching one of these debates, for instance, where the candidates are all standing up there and yakking, let the speeches wash over you as these candidates are talking, and keep on a notepad, jot down every time you have an emotion. You're feeling patriotic, you're feeling fearful, or this or that, and have it under each candidate. Just a short little checklist. You're not trying to determine whether or not what they're saying is true or false, because that's very, very difficult in a debate. You can't do it, which is why what we wind up falling back on is evaluating these guys as performers, like they were in a Broadway play. But just monitor your own emotional reactions to what they're saying. And then, afterwards, now, you take a look at the list. You will now have before you, without having to study what's going on in politics, without having to read Real Clear Politics or listen to NPR or anything else, you'll have a roadmap to what these candidates' strategies are for trying to win and to manipulate the voter to win. you'll see, oh, Chris Christie is using fear. Donald Trump is using fear. Kasich is using hope. And Mario, for at least for a while, was using patriotism and hope, and then he shifted. Now he's the fear and anger candidate. So all of a sudden, in other words, you can use your own brain against itself. And now you'll have real insight into how these guys are trying to manipulate you. And once you understand how they're trying to manipulate you, well, that's a protection. Because then the next time they try to manipulate you, you'll say, ah, I see what he's trying to do right now. And you'll catch him immediately. And you don't have to be a political junkie for this. All you need is your own brain, a pencil and paper, and you can become a very informed voter.
Well, I'm okay. Ready. I'm ready.
We're ready. Rick Schenkman is an Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter and author. He publishes and edits the History News Network. What is that website, History News Network?
What we do is feature op-eds by historians commenting on current events. So if you want to put historical events into historical perspective, come to the website, HNN.
HNN, okay. Political animals, how our Stone Age brain gets in the way of smart politics. Thanks so much, Rick.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And we appreciate your listening. Our producer, Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. And don't forget our free audio archives for download. That's at our website, WLRN.org. Also, the Topical Currents Facebook page is there for links and more information and photos. Perhaps you're feeling hungry. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for Linda Gastheimer's Restaurant Roundabout. You'll hear about some of the great places to dine and perhaps some you'd rather not dine. We'll have reviewers who follow the business. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.